day and in this culture today, you want to be sure and spend some measure of energy and time on risk management. You just can't leave that out these days. We live in a different world, as you know full well, than we did 20, 30 years ago, even 5 or 10 years ago. Things are changing, sometimes changing a lot faster than what we wish they would. So we're here for you. There's not very many days that go by that I don't get a call from one of my clients from somewhere. And I have clients from literally from Minnesota to Oklahoma, and it's a joy to serve and work with each one. Beautiful thing about technology is they can, every one of them, reach me on my cell phone right here. I was on the way down here today, Eric can tell you. I solved a situation right here today for a pastor in Omaha, Nebraska. And I'm able to do that, and that's what we aim to do, you know, for you. It's a joy to share with you in these times together. I'd love to put a quote together on your church's buildings and liability. Fortunately, most claims happen at the level of buildings. And the top 10, or out of the top 10 claims, about 7 or 8 of them are building-related situations. So many times we're able to plug in there. Eric's going to be dealing with the liability portion, so that's going to be unique. And hopefully some of you guys will have questions that will trip him up. That would be great. I'd love to be sitting here and just kind of chuckling and all of that, just listening to how he answers some of these questions during the Q&A time afterwards. But before I was in the insurance realm, I was a pastor. Served for 25 years, and love pastors and love churches, I'm in your court. When I resigned my last pastorate, I said, you know, there's got to be a way of helping churches be able to grow and strengthen their people in sharing their faith. So I pulled a few guys along beside me, formed a corporation we called iOutreach Incorporated. And there's a little brochure back here. Talked with a pastor not long ago. He said, you know, Sky, I'm on the back side of my pastoral ministry. And looking back, I wish that I would have spent more time teaching my people how to share their faith. And that's exactly what iOutreach does. Just go on that website, and it's self-explanatory how it works and everything. If I can help you, we'd love to do that as well. But what a joy today to share with you and introduce to you Eric Spacek. He is the director for risk management and loss control with Guide One. He has guys beneath him all around the country. Guide One is one of the top two premier church insurance carriers in the country. And I emphasize that because there are not very many niche carriers out there. Occasionally, I come across a carrier that's not a niche market carrier. One of them is a huge, huge insurance company in the United States. They insure one out of every four Americans, but they're not a niche church carrier. And the result of that is, even though they're a great carrier, a great company, they're going to have gaps in their coverage as it relates to the church. Why? Because the church is a very unique entity, unlike any other business entity or commercial enterprise. You have some unique coverages that are very important for you to have, and unless you have a niche market church insurance carrier, you are probably not going to have all of those gaps covered. So be sure and talk to me or pick up some of our brochures or what have you out there. We'd love to visit with you. Eric directs this whole thing with Guide One. He directs the loss control, risk management, important figure for our company. And it's a joy to introduce him to you today. Prior to Guide One, he was a trial attorney in Washington, D.C., represented companies of various kinds against litigation, lawsuits. And then after that, he was an administrator at a large a large church in Raleigh, North Carolina. So for the last coming up on 10 years now, he's been with us at Guide One, and he loves the Lord. You'll like Eric. He's a low-key guy, and he'll be here to guide you through some material and then answer some questions afterwards. God bless.
Thank you, Sky. Thank you for having me, giving us the opportunity to be with you. It's great to be here. I understand I'm the only thing standing in your way for a picnic dinner. Is that right? So we'll see. They never did really tell me how much time I had, so we'll see how that goes. And we may deviate from this program somewhat. You know, in conversations with Ron, we had discussion. This was kind of billed as a child safety type event, which we'll certainly discuss that. But there was talk also about safe hiring practices. So whether it's hiring workers or hiring volunteers, just wanted to touch on that. But as much as anything, would want to answer any questions that you have. I wanted to share what we see as a insurance company of churches and religious institutions, what we're seeing on the claim side, things that you may not think about, but definitely want to hear from you, and I'm sure I'll be stumped by some of the questions that you have. But as Sky mentioned, Guide One insures about 45,000 organizations, churches primarily across the country, including a number of meetings. I've had the privilege of speaking at the Philadelphia yearly meeting at the Arch Street Meeting House down there in Center City, Philadelphia, and some various meetings throughout the country. So it's great for me to be able to talk to different groups kind of across all faith beliefs as we go into this topic of church insurance and church safety. As Sky mentioned, I was an attorney for about 11 years in Washington, D.C., defending companies, businesses, nonprofits against liability lawsuits from people getting hurt and suing the company. And it was kind of frustrating for me that as an attorney, it was always on the back end. I was kind of the cleanup, and I really had a desire and a passion to be on the front end. And so combine that with my passion for churches, I really had a vision to be kind of out there providing risk management education to churches across the country to prevent them from being in court where I was. So I had that vision, but God kind of had other plans for me. And so as Sky mentioned, I ended up being, for one reason or another, a church administrator for a church in North Carolina, and did that for 3 years. So 11 years as a trial lawyer, 3 years working in the church. I say only half jokingly, it was tougher being in the church than doing the trial lawyer stuff. And then this door opened up about 10 years ago, where I have the privilege of going around the country and talking to church folks. Like Sky said, we're on your side. I don't have to sell an insurance policy. He does. I don't have to process a claim or deal with a claim. My only role is in what we call risk management and loss control. And so that's providing education to help prevent claims, prevent lawsuits, prevent people from getting injured and making claims against the church. And it really is, in my mind, the ministry that I have, and I'm very fortunate to do that, blessed to do that, and just fortunate to be able to go around and talk to folks like you. And it's not like I'm coming down from on high saying, here's the answer, here's what you have to do. The reason I love these groups is we learn so much from each other. I don't have all the answers. I can share some things that I've seen, some of my experiences. I can share what I've seen other churches, meetings, other organizations doing. And then I think we learn so much from each other as well. So basically, as a church insurer of 45,000 churches, we have a number of claims. And as Sky mentioned, those are driven really by the property claims, by the storms, by the water damage, by fires. And certainly there's things to do to prevent that. When you talk about what we call the casualty or liability claims, that's where people are getting injured or hurt. Overwhelmingly, the number one reason for people being hurt at church, and hopefully it's okay if I just say church versus meeting, is that going to work, is falls. So people falling down and hurting themselves, very often it's from the condition of the parking lot to the condition of the sidewalks to the condition of the carpeting to having extension cords lying around to loose handrails to inadequate lighting, if you will. So sometimes when we think about church insurance claims or liability claims, we'll think about the child safety stuff. We'll think about the horrible incidents of abuse that we'll be talking about. But far and away for us, the number one on the people side is falls. So that really gets back to the property, as I was saying. So really even our number one liability claim deals with property many times, the condition of the property, which is why we often really stress churches to have some sort of team, particularly on the property side, to do regular inspections around the facility to to make sure that the property is in good condition and prevent the falls. Then as you kind of work your way down the liability or casualty, the people claims, if you will, below that is recreational activities, which certainly involves children. That involves the sports leagues, the playgrounds, the youth activities, all things along those nature. And then below that would be the incidents of abuse and misconduct. Those are, in my mind, the worst claims that we have. We have a specialized team of folks on our claims side that's all they deal with. And you pray for those individuals. This is what they see every day. We have about 10 to 15 of those new claims per month involving children and youth, but also adult claims of misconduct. So 10 to 15 per month, 120 to 150 per year of churches of all denominations, of all faiths, urban churches, rural churches. One thing you might not be tuned into is 80% of those claims involve minor children victims. 20% involve adult misconduct claims, typically in the counseling scenario with a pastor and a counselee, if you will, that involves into a relationship that then ends up in a claim situation. And of those 80% that involve children victims, 20% of the time that involves another child. So of that 80% where it's a child victim, 20% of the time the perpetrator, if you will, is another child, another minor. So that's something we don't think about a lot. We often think about it being the adult youth worker with the young child or with the teenage worker. But how about, the 11 or 12-year-old who's helping out in the nursery, or we even get the claims where it's two teens in the youth group who get involved, who get off in some way and are involved in a relationship, and then the parents find out, and then there's a claim against the church. And we're going to talk today about kind of safe hiring practices, but that really all gets into supervision, about how you're supervising the children, because obviously you're not hiring them. But so just something to think about as we talk about the topic. And so just wanted to start off talking about safe hiring practices and background checks. And I don't know, is that an issue for y'all, background checks? Do you do background checks, or is this kind of where you feel you know everybody? So we're doing background. Okay, Ron's shaking his head yes, so good. Okay, let me, this cartoon is a little hard to make out, but it was, I just think it really captures some of the conflicting values that we're talking about. It was actually done by a very talented cartoonist in the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. And you'll see the sign on the right side, first day school, teachers wanted. So we have a lady that's in charge of the children, obviously in need of help with the crying kids. And then we have our Jesus figure on the left side, and she's saying, great, we just need proof you've never been convicted of child abuse. And I just thought it captured so well kind of the conflicting emotions that we have, the conflicting thoughts that we have about we need help, we have someone that we know and we trust, and yet we kind of have to put them through these hoops, if you will. And so I just really appreciated that cartoon, and I thought myself, for the kind of the values that we're talking about. But it's kind of gets back to the concept from a politician about trust but verify, that we want to be able to trust the people that are coming in to work with the kids, but we really need as leaders to verify that they should be working with minors, because if you don't do the verification part, the consequences against the organization can be extreme, as we see with the claims and lawsuits that come along. So we want to talk about that verify part. This is a slide that was shared with us by a background screening company that we work with called Single Source. They're just changing their name to ClearStar, and some of their information is on the table, but it's saying, what do applicants lie about? Just from their experience, what is the data showing that 29% of applicants are lying about the dates of their employment? So maybe that's not that big a deal. It's dates of employment. 21% about the degrees or education that they've attained. 27% kind of give bogus or phony references. And then 7% lie about the fact that they have a felony. So if we just go on their word, in terms of that worker, whether it's a volunteer or an employee, you can run into trouble. And we see it all the time in terms of churches where something has happened at the church, if they had done their kind of their due diligence, if you will, they would have learned that either one, the individual had a criminal history, and sometimes a very extensive criminal history, or two, that there had been issues with this individual at other churches, nonprofits, other organizations in the past. So I know this is a lot of work, but this is really our proposed approach to bringing on workers or volunteers. So this is very common. This is not unique to Guide One. This is kind of what you see throughout nonprofits. And in fact, one thing that you hear about is what is one reason that churches are vulnerable to some of these predators coming into the church is that where else can somebody in this society come in and immediately go to work with children? Can you think of another organization where they can do that? If you go to Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Big Brother, Big Sister, they've got extensive screening programs. If you go to pretty much any other nonprofit, if they go to a school, there's pretty much extensive screening. And so churches are vulnerable by not having the screening process. So I put this out there. It's also in the handout with the kind of the slides there, 3 to a page, about what we would recommend. And you know, this is just recommendations, just thoughts. You know, churches and meetings need to do what they're comfortable with and what works for them. And we certainly see where there's different levels of this for different levels of things. If you're hiring someone as an employee, you may be more extensive in terms of what you're doing. If it's just somebody volunteering to work with kids, it may be somewhat less. But some of the points, and these are just best practices of screening people to working with children particularly, is one, a 6-month waiting period. And this is just for volunteers because you're going to be doing more screening probably with employees. So for volunteers, a 6-month waiting period. And the intent there is twofold. One is you want to deter those that want quick and easy access to the children so they can come right in and work with the kids right away. Two is you want that period of time just to get to know the individual, make sure that they are well-suited to working with children. And so I was pleased. I didn't run into this till yesterday. I probably should have seen it before then. But it was the Iowa Yearly Meetings Misconduct Policy, Child Protection Policy. It was on the website. Is that still? That's still. Uh-oh. Maybe I shouldn't have. Well, and it talks about kind of the 6-month, we call it 6-month waiting period, if you will, for volunteers. So can I talk about this at all, Ron? So it was out on the website. Is it? It's kind of out there. It's a great document. It's freely available. It says, Iowa Yearly Meeting or whichever monthly meeting is committed to creating a safe and healthy environment in which young people can learn about and experience God's love. In order to ensure this, we expect that all people applying to be volunteers who work with minors will have been members/attenders for at least 6 months. So that's a basic 6-month waiting period, a basic safeguard, if you will. The next step then being an application of some sort. Again, it may be different for employees versus volunteers, but basically just looking for information on the individual, where they have been affiliated with in terms of church or meeting experience, where they've been affiliated with in terms of nonprofit or other experience working with children, a statement from them about criminal convictions, if they have any criminal convictions, and then just basic employment history. So again, that document includes a sample volunteer application and disclosure form. It's just a 3-page document that's attached to the document that's out on the website. So it's a good document. I mean, it's kind of got the basics in there in terms of an application form. And again, like I said, many places do different things for employees versus volunteers. Some may not do all these things for volunteers because, as that cartoon suggested, we're in desperate need of volunteers, and so we don't want to put up walls, if you will. The interview, I mean, again, just to get to know them, just to eyeball them if you're not familiar with them before you put them in a place of trust with minors. And then wanted to spend a few minutes on the last two items, which are reference checks and criminal background checks, which are kind of the linchpins, if you will, of safe screening practices. It's what we see so many organizations doing. And so just want to touch base, reference checks, background checks. Let's see here. And, you know, we really view the reference check as complementary to the background check, that there are clearly things that you'll get from the reference check that you won't get from the background check and vice versa. Just that example earlier, someone may have a clean criminal history. In many cases, they do, but there are a number of issues at previous places where they've served. So being able to get to that information if you're able to, or those that have had a sterling history of working in other places but have a terrible criminal background check. And so being able to get both of those pieces of information, we recommend at least two reference checks, and ideally what we call of an institutional nature versus a personal reference, you know, a relative or friend, ideally trying to get where they've worked or volunteered with minors in the past would be the ideal scenario. And then whether it's telephone or written, there's pros and cons to both. We find typically you get more information by the telephone reference check and then documenting the check so that you have kind of the proof that you've done due diligence. If anything ever did happen, heaven forbid, and the meeting was sued because of an incident involving a child, you know, you're not going to be judged by people of faith. You're going to be judged by people in the community. And they're going to look at you and say, did you do, and this is your standard, reasonable care. You have a duty of reasonable care. You don't have a duty to be an insurer of everybody at the meeting, just reasonable care. And so part of that reasonable care is what reasonable steps did you take to see that the children were safe? And so that's really what we're striving to do. And so some of the proof of that can be showing the application form, showing the documentation of the reference check, showing that the criminal background check was done. There's not a court in Iowa that's found that these are required of churches, but in terms of defending yourself or defending your meeting, to have done this is just so beneficial to you to show that you're acting with reasonable care. And as I said, more and more it's becoming the standard. So I'm not aware of a court in Iowa that's found this, but if you don't do some of these things, ultimately that will be the standard, that you'll be found negligent for not doing some of these things. It's just the direction that we're heading. What about anybody doing reference checks, or is that too much stuff? Anybody doing them? You guys are doing them? Good. Sometimes you'll call, and they'll just say, "Yeah, he or she was employed here from such and such a date." That's all I can tell you. They call it a neutral reference because the person that you're calling, they're worried about liability about saying anything. So what do you do in those situations? Or do they just won't talk to you? I mean, there really isn't anything that you can do for that particular reference because that's all they're going to give you. Perhaps you can glean something out of the way that they communicate that message to you. Otherwise, it's just a matter of moving on to the next reference, documenting whatever they told you, and then move on to the next reference. Certainly, you can document that you did that reference check. And then we get questions from organizations. Just to flip it on the other side for a second, is what if somebody calls you and says, such and such, who used to be at your meeting, wants to work with kids, what about it? Are they good for that or not? And so, again, you might have concern for liability about saying anything. So these are just some thoughts. More and more, before people contact references, they'll sign a release form allowing them to do that. So you may want to see the release form from the other organization that this individual has signed before you say anything, or you can do the neutral reference, you know, the dates of employment, the position, and that's about it. You probably don't, if you know that they've got something in their background, the one thing you wouldn't want to do is tell them, oh, they were great with kids, when you know that there were issues in the past, because that's when you can really run into trouble. Not so much not telling anything, but giving the total opposite of what it was. So we've seen some churches that have gotten sued for providing this positive, glowing reference to somebody where there had been issues in the back. So any questions on this stuff? Is this? Yes, ma'am.
That second one, if responding, seek release form, just the facts. So the person who is asking for
data. Yeah, it's kind of right, that the whatever organization is contacting you, you'd ask to see kind of the release form showing that this person has signed, saying, yeah. So, And then if you do proceed, the just the facts part is about not stating opinions, really, but just stating your observations and trying to just state the facts that you've seen. Not a lot of fun stuff. Not what we went into ministry for, is it? But unfortunately, it can be a reality in today's world about these kinds of things. I wanted to move on to background check. Oh, sorry, Ron. Yes.
How do you get a small local church, 30 people, 50 people, convinced that they ought to do the reference check?
Yeah.
And I've been called a lot of times for reference checks, and sometimes the caller will say, it'll just take a couple of minutes, I got a few questions, and then 75 questions later, I'm asking... Yeah. You know, when do I get paid? I guess it's really tough, I think, to ask a volunteer to check on a volunteer and know how to do it. You know, we don't have professional HR departments, which is a whole new device that we all live with. But how do you persuade?
Sure. Persuade is hard. I mean, you're not always going to be able to persuade. We try to persuade by... stories and statistics, such as some of the things that we shared up front about the number of claims that are going on, about some of the stories that we've seen. For the small church, so many times it can't happen here is the attitude or the approach. And so we do what we can. We talk about stories, we talk about statistics, and we talk about values, that it's part of our values. It's part of being a steward. It's part of being a shepherd. It's part of expressing love one to another, to do these things, to protect the children, and that me as a staff member, I'm the first one. This is being done to me as well, at least on the background check piece of it. So it's not just you. We're all in this together as we're trying to make our meeting the safest place that we can. May not be effective, but it's what we try to do. So stories, statistics that are available, and then values. And we usually start off with the value piece, but frankly, for some, we just see it's not going to happen until something happens, which is unfortunate, but it's something that we see. As far as what questions to ask, I've got a few copies here. There's a, when I mentioned the documentation of reference check, there's just a sample documentation of reference check form. So it has about 2 to 3 pages of questions. And again, you would just modify as you wanted to see fit about the types of questions that you might want to be asking when you're seeking a reference and then documenting the response. As far as those, when you get called and you got 75 questions, I don't know what to do about that other than, you know, letting them know how much time you have available and trying to cut that off to the extent possible. And, you know, you're doing them a favor, really, by doing that. So. Sky.
Eric, I might just mention, too, that, you know, that our churches, our meetings are reaching out to bring people into them and instruct them in the message of the gospel and all of that. We have to keep in mind that they're mamas and their daddies in the house down the street are wondering, is this church a safe place for my child to go to? And so that's very helpful because it gives them a great deal of reassurance when they know that your church, your meeting, is a safe place, and the people, you know, have done the background work needed.
That's a great point. That's something that folks have talked to us about this being part of how they, part of their ministry outreach is kind of their child protection program is part of what they advertise in terms of keeping the children safe. Other churches that we talk to talk about, we do this because we know that we build this ministry for year upon year upon year. All it takes is one incident. And you know when it involves a child, it's going to the media. And your meeting is going to be in the media for reasons you definitely don't want it to be in the media. And all that work year upon year can really drag down the whole ministry. So again, it's just, again, trying to persuade the folks to take action based on some of those kind of ideas. So criminal background checks are, again, uncomfortable. You know, we're in the religious setting, and we're saying, well, before you can work with kids, we need to see your criminal background. But again, it's something across all those that work with kids, it's being done. For those that want to work with kids, it shouldn't be a foreign concept to them because everywhere else, pretty much other than the church, is doing it. And more churches and meetings are doing it, thankfully. You know, we insure, as I mentioned, a lot of churches. We like to think we have the best customers, kind of the cream of the crop. So we would think, you know, the folks that are applying for positions to work with kids at our churches are going to have probably no convictions at all. So we got this data from one of the screening vendors that we worked with that kind of across all industries, the hit rate, if you will, a typical hit rate where they find a crime in the background is about 6%. For all of our policyholders who are the cream of the crop, it was 5.2%, so not very different. 5.2% means one out of every 20 person that's applying to work with kids has some type of criminal conviction in their background. So take a congregation of 100, you know, 20 people. It's a reality. It may be things that aren't disqualifying. It may be things that are maybe embarrassing to them. But a part of working with kids is kind of going through this process and being upfront with the congregation that this is our process. And if somebody does have something in their background, maybe they don't want to go through that process, which is fine. They don't need to kind of work with the kids. Some of the examples of what we saw too wasn't just minor stuff necessarily. They kind of reported to us some of our policyholder applicants had, you know, murder, rape, unlawful intercourse with a minor, some kind of significant crimes, obviously. And again, another point when we talk about background checks is more than half of those convictions were from another state. So there are a lot of different options for running background checks. A lot of them are statewide, which is good, but as much as you can do a more broad net, kind of nationwide, the better it is, kind of based on this data. Yes, ma'am, please.
Is that on? Can you think of an example of something that you might find in a background check that looks bad at first, but if you had an opportunity, someone explained that to you, that, like, for instance, this is the only one I can think of, but I was thinking in Iowa that if you streak, like if you're on a college campus and you streak, that's actually, you can get a fine for that, or if it's a felony. Yeah. But that might have happened when you were 18 and you were in college and you were silly or whatever, and then now you're 35 and that's still on your record. Yeah. Can you think of any other examples of like that would, we could go, oh, that's something we could ask them about or something that they could maybe explain more? Can you think of a specific, or is that a really broad thing to try to?
There are all kinds of convictions. When you see these reports, you see all kinds of things. And so what you really want to do is, one, look at the nature of the offense, look at how long ago it was, and then if it is something that's questionable, you know, it's not a violent crime or it's not a sex crime, obviously provide them an opportunity to provide an explanation for it, such as that, you know, this was in my college days or along those lines. So this brochure on the table, and we'll get to some of this perhaps, from the blue one that says Clear Star, we actually worked with them on a lot of the content, and one of the specific questions was about what's a disqualifying offense. It's question number 8, I think, on the third page about what crimes disqualify someone from working with children. So when you get the criminal report back, really, what is a disqualifier? It's really going to be up to your meeting to decide what that disqualifier is. We don't try to tell you, you know, it has to be X. It's a broad range of things. One thing that we often say is to check with local schools or check with other charities about what they kind of consider to be disqualifying offenses, and then at a minimum follow what they're doing so that you can be considered to be following the standard of care in your community. I looked at Iowa real quick because we deal with churches all over. But I looked at Iowa real quick before I came over, and just the Department of Education had something about their only real automatic disqualifiers were forcible felonies, and they didn't list them out, but you could find out what those were, and any sexual offense involving a child. So it sounded like from that even a sexual offense involving adult wasn't an automatic disqualifier from the State Board of Education, as far as I could tell. But, you know, that's really for your meeting to decide which ones are. Typically, we would say crimes of violence and then any crime involving a child. And then beyond that, it may be discretionary, and you'd want to consider the nature of the incident, how long ago it was, and any circumstances that they shared about that. And what we would typically recommend, again, is if you decide to place them with kids anyway, it might be somewhat questionable, is to document your thought process, because you're going to be judged on, were you following a reasonable standard of care? If you can come in and say, this is what we were thinking, we met with them, we got this information, we felt that they're, you know, maybe we checked with others, we felt that there was not a risk or a low risk at this time. It helps to document your level of reasonable care, if you will. But there are a lot of examples out there. You'll see a lot of drug stuff, DUI stuff, along those lines. So how many, dare I ask, how many meetings are running background checks in here? Some here, yeah. So, you know, it's a topic that I wish were real simple and easy for us in the religious world, but it's a little complicated. It's complicated because there's not really a true national background check. There's an FBI database that is probably the closest thing to that, but we typically in the private sector don't have access to that. That's typically limited to law enforcement. And so there are a lot of background screening companies out there, and they'll talk about national or multi-state background checks, but it's really not a true national background check. The way I describe it is the best that we can do is cast as broad a net as you can, given the tools that you have available. So for us, we have this relationship with ClearStar. They have what's called a multi-state background check. Basically, if you talk to anybody in the industry, and again, I wish it was really simple, but it's not. If you talk to anybody in the background screening industry, the most, other than the FBI, the most thorough or accurate background check is at the county level. Because county will then may or may not report it up, may report it to others, but the best, I say best, background check would be at the county level. There's two issues with that. One is it's only one county, and two, it's expensive to go county by county by county. So it's not really practical in most circumstances for us to run a county by county search through the 99 counties of Iowa. So we typically talk about running that multi-state background check, which captures a lot of that county data, but not all of it by any means in any state. So there may be circumstances where it makes sense to combine that multi-state check with a county check. Like I said, I wish it was simpler. I would encourage you, obviously, you know, Guide One, we don't run background checks. The Safe Church site that we operate doesn't run background checks. It's actually the background screening company that runs the background checks. So meetings are free to choose whoever you want. I'm sure there are various companies that you all are utilizing. Would encourage you to talk to them about what makes the most sense in your area to run a background check, because there's the cost piece too, obviously. The multi-state check that we're talking about, $7.95 per person. The county by county is typically $8 to $12 per county. So you do 10 counties, you're talking over $100. You know, we're talking about protecting the kids, yes, but there's also the financial reality of it. So in a lot of cases, and from my conversations, most folks in Iowa are just running that multi-state, the $7.95 search, and it's a pretty good search. Just recognize it's not foolproof. It's not, you're not going to get everything, but it's a pretty good search. So, yes, ma'am. Questions?
Just because you get the criminal, isn't there a whole other layer of child abuse that may not rise to the criminal? So we're not touching that with this.
That's a great question, and I wish I had the answer in Iowa, but aside from the criminal stuff, there's a whole child abuse kind of investigation, whether it's a founded or unfounded. That's typically the end result. If it's founded, it may go into a criminal case. So Department of Human Services investigates something. They determine whether it's a founded or unfounded thing, and then if it's founded, depending on the circumstances, it may go into a criminal case. So there's that whole other, like I said, I wish it was simpler, but there's a whole other body of information. In some states, you can go and get that as a separate search, the DHS search. I know in Pennsylvania, that's another $10 search. I'm just not entirely sure. I tried to look real quick on Iowa. I didn't see that as being available from DHS in Iowa. Does anybody know that? I haven't seen it that you can.
$18,
you think, for that? So, yes.
So we have the criminal.
Okay, so a lot of the criminal ones will incorporate the sex offender search. If not, Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's free, actually. So I was just going to talk about that one, but this gentleman had a question, then we'll get to the sex offender registry.
I guess, I don't know if it would be legal or not, but if you were asking somebody, you know, a signature to do a background check, could you ask them to list, like, maybe every county they lived in or every state? That way you could do a more thorough search.
Absolutely. You can ask them, yep, that's no problem doing that. Again, it's a cost factor, it's a cost and time factor, but if you're going to be entirely detailed. It's really, kind of getting back to the beginning, it's really a balancing act. A balancing act between how thorough and then how much cost involved in it. So again, in a lot of states, that multi-state search is a good search. It certainly provides a lot of records from around the country, including Iowa. Ma'am, did you want to say something?
Yes. In Iowa, there's Iowa Courts Online, and you can do a background criminal and misdemeanor search on anybody. So all you need is their information to put in, and it's free to the public. And from that point, depending upon what it pulls up, because it could pull up many, many, many different things, you can go through and figure out from there if you need to do a further deeper search.
Search each name they've ever had. Good point. And that's why, hopefully on the application form, like the addresses, you're asking for prior names as well. This doesn't sound simple, does it? I wish it was simpler. Let me, you know, again, each meeting's got to decide how they want to deal with the background checks, whether you want to just do the multi-state, you want to get more involved, or if you're not doing any, this is the one that's, it's free to the public, it's nationwide, it's a kind of a clearinghouse of all the sex offender registries across all 50 states. I describe it as better than nothing, but not complete. All you're doing is running their name. That's all the information that's put into that site. It runs the name against all the sex offender registries across the country. If it returns hits, there'll be photos, and you can determine whether that's your person or that's somebody else. It's free to the public. It's kind of what it looks like. You just enter a first name and last name. Obviously, we're talking about casting a broad net. There are a lot of holes in this net. It's only as good as the data that's being updated from each state. It's only things that will put you on the sex offender registry, which are the more serious sex crimes. So the lesser sex crimes and any violent crimes aren't going to be on this. But it's due diligence. It's showing that you're doing some screening of the workers. So hopefully, if nothing else, this could be a tool to you if you haven't gone the route of the commercial or the paid criminal background checks. Has anyone utilized this tool? I know I've looked at it. Problem is, if you got a John Smith volunteering for you, you're going to be looking through about 300 photographs, trying to see if that's your guy. Oh, man. Not to complicate it anymore. Maybe I should skip this slide. But background checks are a regulated industry, so when you're running commercial background checks, deal with that commercial screening company. They're going to help you with this FCRA, or Fair Credit Reporting Act, requirements. It basically talks about giving them the applicant disclosure. It talks about giving them an opportunity to dispute the results and about them getting notice before you take some adverse action based on the background check. So just talk to your screening company about that, particularly if you're going to be taking some action based on what the background check showed. EEOC, that's the most recent thing where, what's that? For volunteers, yeah. So the EEOC has been finding that criminal background checks disproportionately impact minorities. So they're concerned that using a criminal background check could be discriminatory in that sense. So that's the latest thing in the background check piece that I wish I didn't mention, but really their guidance is, and it hasn't been, They're looking at the big, big employers. They're not looking at churches. But their guidance is that really the background check has to be job related, kind of a business necessity. So working with kids, a background check is easily kind of falls in that category of business related or business necessity. And that in making decisions on background checks, you should consider the nature and gravity of the offense, kind of what we talked about, the time that has passed since the offense, and then the nature of the job held or sought. So really, it's not come down to churches yet at all. It's just floating out there about what the EEOC is doing. But basically what they're saying is you kind of need to consider this case by case on the facts of it. And we're doing that anyway when we get the information back on the background check. So sorry to complicate that for you. That's just something that's out there. The national background check I talked about, the availability of data. I kind of mentioned that not every county reports all the data. Not all the states have good data. And then I probably in the interest of time, how long do I have, Ron, by the way? I won't go over all these questions. They're all in this little pamphlet about what you need to know about background screening. So again, this is with the ClearStar, the screening company that we work with, but we actually wrote most of the material in there. We briefly talked about what crimes would disqualify someone. How long do we keep background check records? That just gets into the fact that if there is a claim involving a minor, they can wait. They don't typically, but they can wait until they become an adult and then have a year beyond that to file a lawsuit. So it doesn't happen often, but you could be sued for something that happened 12 years ago and someone just became an adult. So we typically recommend talk to your screening company about holding those indefinitely or saving them electronically for an indefinite period of time, unless it's restricted by the state. Yes, sir? Yeah, the guidelines are just about being, I mean, it's not very specific. I haven't seen regulations on it, but just about the confidential nature of it, typically locked in a file cabinet or secured on a drive, on a computer drive, something along those lines. So nothing real detailed that I've seen on that one. Question three, real quick. What if the person that you want to work with kids is themselves a minor? Do you run a background check on them? Because if they did something when they were a minor, probably went to juvenile court, and you can't get access to those records. So it's up to you. Some places, as a matter of due diligence, run background checks on everybody, knowing that they're not going to get any information back on the minor. And if they do that, sometimes they'll want to increase other parts of their screening of minors, maybe checking where they've babysat or worked with kids in the past if they aren't otherwise doing that. So, and last one we often get, how often do we rerun them? So it's not necessarily once and done. Up to you. We don't require anything. I would say most places 2 to 5 years is common. Talk to the background screening companies. They say more and more annual is moving to the standard, but they kind of have a financial interest in that. So if you know Richard Hammer of Church Law and Tax Report, I don't know if you know that publication. He was just commenting on the report from Louis Free and the Jerry Sandusky scandal in Pennsylvania. In that report, one of the recommendations was to rerun background checks every 5 years. So again, it's not required, but it's just a recommendation. Let me pause there and see if there are questions or if you want to talk about some things related to this. I know we're talking mostly about child safety, but wanted to open it up. So, yes, sir.
One of the other issues that can come up, and I've seen it come up a couple times in churches, is where you have a sex offender, perhaps somebody, I know of a specific example, sent to federal penitentiary, became a Christian.
Yeah.
Then he comes back to go to church, not wanting to work with the kids, but what responsibilities does the church have for risk management?
Yeah. That's a great question. That's another toughie, and it's the balance. Again, remembering, unfortunately, that if anything happens, we're not judged by people of the church who understand forgiveness and redemption. We're judged by the community who are thinking, why would you ever? So three options for the church. One is just allow them back with unfettered access like any other member, not recommended by us. Two is, and some churches do this, they tell them we're not equipped to handle that here, so they'll actually say, essentially not invite them onto the property, which is a tough one because we're in ministry. So the third option, which is probably the most common, but again involves work, is kind of a chaperoned or monitored attendance for the individual. Recommend that they meet with the church leaders to get an understanding of their background. Not uncommon that they have some sort of probation or parole agreement that might limit where they can be, which might even say you can't be around children, so it might be default say we can't have you here, unfortunately, but that's the state saying they can't do that versus us. To talk to them about conditions of their attendance, that they won't go into the youth areas, they won't be unattended throughout the church, but kind of sit down with them with the kind of the agreed upon guidelines and have somebody typically would kind of be their chaperone from the time they're on the property until the time they leave. And that's a lot of work. I mean, that's a lot of things, but it's a way to protect the meeting from liability in the event something happens. So it feels kind of crazy, doesn't it, to talk about that kind of stuff. But it's a reality. I mean, it's...
They did the chaperone in the main worship area, no problem. But that the individual understood that he could not go outside of that, you know, other than walking out the door, without somebody approved from the church to go with him, and he was, you know, at that point in his life, he was okay with that because, I mean, he came to the church. He said, "This is what's happened, but I want to be in church," and that's what they worked out, and it worked. But it's just one of those things that would be really difficult.
Kind of a related point there is the communication of that, about how far do you go in terms of communicating that to the congregation. So hopefully that would be part of that initial meeting with the individual about who's going to be notified of your status, if you will. Because you as a parent, you'd want to know, wouldn't you, if somebody was in your meeting like that. So some places announce it to everybody. Some places announce it just to church leadership. Some places announce it just to the youth and children's leaders, so it's really up to them. But being part of that initial meeting to avoid any claims from him or her, just to have an agreement about who all is going to be notified of your status. So, yeah. We can talk about what if something happens, kind of a worst case scenario. And I had this together, and then I saw that the, you know, there's a whole plan for responding that the yearly meeting has put out, so I don't want to kind of get into too much detail on what we've said, but clearly one topic, and I'll just go through here, is the issue of mandatory reporting, just to make sure you're aware of it, because it varies state by state, that if you become aware of abuse, that you have an obligation to report it to the state. And if you don't report it, you can actually be found criminally responsible for that. We just had an incident, one of our insureds, where three church leaders in Colorado were just criminally convicted, not for being involved in abuse, but for not reporting it to the state. They wanted to kind of handle it on their own. They were mandatory reporters under the state law, didn't notify the authorities. Ultimately, the authorities found out and prosecuted not just the perpetrator, but also the church leaders for not reporting it. So... I looked at Iowa real quick. If you have a school, it could certainly be a mandatory reporter, but this is from DHS. What they say is clergy members are not considered to be mandatory reporters unless they're functioning as social workers. Well, we're always functioning as social workers, aren't we? Counselors are another role described as a mandatory reporter. So just good to be familiar with the mandatory reporting law in Iowa, or maybe there's other states here too, but this guide is too much. It's on the DHS website, but it's about 100 pages. It's a guide for mandatory reporters in Iowa. Anybody in these states here? I thought there might be, but maybe not. Nope. Okay. We'll skip Wisconsin and Minnesota. I'm sorry?
Let's see Wisconsin. We have a couple churches in Wisconsin.
So they are specifically listed as a mandatory reporter of child abuse in Wisconsin, except if it's in a confidential clergy-penitent discussion that the individual discloses this, then the clergy is not required to report it in Wisconsin at that state, but that's always a dicey situation. None of this stuff is simple, is it? I wish it was. If you're not a mandatory reporter, you're still you can voluntarily report abuse if you become aware of it or have reason to suspect it. So Iowa has this hotline that's available 24/7, and then the other states, it's typically contacting your local DHS office.
Eric,
yes,
question,
sir.
Question, please.
Yes.
Ran into this firsthand and upon entry into a local church as a pastor.
Oh, this is going to stump me, I can tell.
No, no, it'll probably be easy for you. But we had an RN, registered nurse, who saw something she thought was inappropriate during vacation Bible school and said, well, I'm a mandatory reporter, so I've got to report this. Mm-hmm. Which didn't go down well with the people involved in the VBS and stuff, and it really escalated, mm-hmm. you know, caused a great deal of division and disharmony.
Yes.
And I've always wondered about that.
Uh-huh.
You know, they weren't in the role of as a registered nurse at the time, but yet mm-hmm. I think we're pretty well taught that as a teacher and all these other roles, it doesn't matter. So it really becomes a fine line, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the statute, I'd have to go back to it. It doesn't say, you know, in that situation, healthcare while acting in the healthcare setting. I mean, if you're in that role and you, and I think the statute is usually a reasonable suspicion or reasonable cause to believe that someone's been abused, that's usually the standard, then they have an obligation to report. So certainly understand where she was coming from in her profession. I know that's the way that typically they're trained, that if they become aware of that situation. I see some folks nodding, so anyone else have experience with that?
Yeah.
Or where? Nurses? So what would you say to that?
I would say it doesn't matter where you are. You're a mandatory reporter. If you're not in
the
nursing environment.
Yeah, that's kind of, but I understand the kind of the consternation that can be involved with that. Yes, ma'am.
As a history of, I was a child abuse investigator and all that, and the way I was trained is you can't, only when you're in treatment, you know, or you're acting in your duty, are you mandatory? Otherwise, you're permissive, which is a little different, you know, than what they're saying. But that's the way I was, you know, trained. So
I guess we'll have to go to that 108-page guide and take a look. But it's out there on the DHS.iowa.gov website. Yes, ma'am.
Can you speak at all into the mandatory reporting of parents, of like with the Duggar case, you know, how many kids do they have on TV? I can't think. But, you know, they had an incident of minor with minor. But just thinking about in churches, if that would happen in a family where there was incest or whatever, but that was confessed to the pastor. Is it by state that parents, are you a mandatory reporter if you're a parent or not? Or how, just can you speak into that? Because obviously the Duggars are Christians and they're a part of a local congregation, so how will that play out into their local congregation, or how could it?
Great question. Mandatory reporting is state by state, so each one is different. Typically, it's professions, so I've not seen that it's parents, strangely enough. I'd have to go back to double check that, but it's typically listed professions that are mandatory reporters. And so if you become aware of that as in that profession, then that triggers the duty to know, with some exceptions in some states being that if you learn of it, like in that confidential clergy counseling setting, you wouldn't have the obligation to do that. But if that situation became known to church leaders and there was no exception, then they would have, and there was reason to suspect, it's usually reasonable suspicion is usually the standard, that a child's been abused, and that church leader would have the obligation to report it if they were a mandatory reporter in that state. So That probably didn't answer your question, but it was it is sticky. It is. So, okay. So even beyond that, if you learn of a situation like that where one child is alleged to have molested a sibling, what do you do about that child in your congregation? So that's definitely challenging, you know, in terms of whether it's chaperone or whether it's, not allowing them to be in the children's area. It's difficult. Yes, ma'am. She's looked it up. Perfect.
I am a mandatory reporter because I'm a substitute teacher. Iowa law states, defines classes of people who must make a report of child abuse within 24 hours. Health care, mental health, education, law enforcement, child care, and social work. It also says that your employer cannot stand in the way of you reporting a child abuse. There is a part about clergy in here. Was it up at the top?
It was that part that I mentioned.
Yes. So,
does it say while you're employed, though, while you're working?
No, it does not. Does not say while you're at work. I've had this happen to me. There is a part about the clergy. The clergy says that if a child confesses to you, you have an obligation to report that. As a pastor, in ministerial, when we do outreach for ministerial and we come across a child that's being abused, as a mandatory reporter, I felt obligated. And you have to follow up with a written report. But I do not feel as a teacher and as a pastor that my job stops as a mandatory reporter at the school. And that could be considered more voluntary outside the school, but I do believe we have an obligation.
Thank you. And the site you're looking at is dhs.iowa.gov. So if you go there and search mandatory reporter or child abuse, all that information for Iowa is available. So some other, just real briefly before we get to any questions, resources that are out there. SafeChurch.com is a website for Guide 1 insurance policyholders, freely available. Hopefully if you are a Guide 1 policyholder, you've taken advantage of that, but it is a site that has a number of resources, sample policies, sample documents. It has 7 training videos, including 2 on the topic of child safety or child abuse prevention, which is essentially an online video training, a PDF resource, and then a testing capability. These are the 2 video training modules, a sample youth child protection policy, but you can certainly utilize the annual meetings policy as a sample as well. And this is actually a good resource. It's from the Department of Health and Human Services called Preventing Child Abuse Within Youth-Serving Organizations, Getting Started on Policies and Procedures. So this is a document that's out there on the web as well from the Department of Health and Human Services website. Again, preventing child abuse within youth-serving organizations. And then this is actually a good Iowa-specific one on the topic of kind of employment and safe hiring practices. It's from Iowa Workforce Development. So the actual site is iowaworkforcedevelopment.gov. iowaworkforcedevelopment.gov. And if you just search successful interviewing, it has some pretty good information. This is the little packet right here on writing a job description, discovering applicants' qualifications, avoiding discrimination during the hiring process, summary of pre-employment questions. In other words, the questions that you can ask or can't ask. You know, you can't say, well, how old are you, or things along those lines. And then a sample employment application, although, again, the yearly meeting has that sample kind of application and a disclosure statement that's also a very good resource. So that's a quick run-through of some child safety material, some resources that are out there. As Sky says, we want to be a resource to you. The very last slide on that three page or the three slides per page has my, all my contact information. Would be glad to speak with any of you by email or phone about safety risk management issues. That's all I do, so it's really a blessing to do that, but wanted to open it up to questions. Ron?
Well, I have one that has had quite a bit of press in the last few years.
Oh.
I was handed a document 2 days ago from Indiana Yearly Meeting that they have submitted to the yearly meeting for discernment and perhaps approval in the area of sexual orientation and weddings and such. A document they're trying to develop some language that would protect a pastor who refuses to perform such a wedding. I opted not to try to introduce it unbeknownst to anybody here to just throw it open to a wide open debate this week. But there, since the Supreme Court decision, there's been a number of email, website information has been handed out free on the internet of what you need to do, this is what you got to say, so on and so on. And I know, Sky, you sent some stuff out a little bit about it before the decision was made. It's not going to go away overnight. Right now, I says, are there any specific guidelines that you're concerned about as an insurance company? And it's related. I was already asked this question before I even thought about that part of it. Is there's the government-approved questions you can ask when you're hiring someone. But I'm under the understanding that I'm not totally bound by every one of those in the church. Now, some people try to impose that on the church. So we get into some discussions or debates sometimes. You can't ask this. You can't do that. So how do we know what is legally allowed? And of course, we're all concerned and driven by liability issues everywhere we turn. So can you speak anything to this? And we're going to be done shortly.
So in 1 minute, right? You know, we're concerned for the church because the church needs to follow its convictions and do what churches do. The recent Supreme Court opinion kind of recognized or created, however you want to say it, a fundamental constitutional right out of the 14th Amendment. There is obviously still the First Amendment, freedom of religion, and so it's going to be litigated in future years, that First Amendment, freedom of religion right, conflicting with that 14th Amendment, right to marry, if you will, and it's going to, the church is going to be a battleground for sure. So there's the employment issue, there's the pastoral issue, there's the facility usage issue. And so what we're just recommending at this point is to consider looking at your governing documents, whatever they are, and I'm not entirely sure what your governing documents are, whether it's a constitution, bylaws, as well as your employment handbook, if you have one, as well as your facility usage policy, if you have one, and consider incorporating in there pretty clearly, from a religious perspective, your view. Including incorporating in there as much as possible and as much as makes sense the scriptural or biblical basis for that. Because as of right now, churches, like in the employment context, are free to discriminate on religious reasons. We're not free to discriminate on racial reasons or gender reasons or things like that. Okay. So that's where this is going to play out, is about, is our position a religious position or is it a discriminatory gender or sexual orientation position? As much as we can, in our, whatever documents we have in a meeting, incorporate this as a religious or scriptural basis, including specific scriptural references, the better that we're positioned to say this is a First Amendment freedom of religion position. This isn't a 14th Amendment position. And there are sample, we haven't put out sample resources, but there are sample resources that are out there, sample membership covenants, sample bylaws, sample facility usage provisions. I can share those with you, Ron. You've probably seen some of those if you wanted to distribute them. That's some, like the Christian Law Association has put those out. The Alliance Defending Freedom, another Christian organization, has put out. And they're good, it's good material, but it's going to be a number of years that this is going to be litigated in the courts, because this was just recognizing that civil union issue, and it's much broader for that from the church. Because then down the road, the scary part is if it becomes, are we discriminating because of sexual orientation, then there's the whole threat to our tax-exempt status, which is a huge other issue. So we want to focus it on First Amendment, religious. It's a religious decision, religious, based on our beliefs.
I wanted to make an additional comment. When Iowa State Supreme Court made a decision about same-sex marriage, I got a copy. It's a 42-page document, and they spent quite a bit of time explaining how this was not to be an infringement on religious liberty or religious conviction.
Yeah.
And I'm just kind of, I didn't hear anything about that on this new U.S. Supreme Court situation, so I'm wondering how that might play out.
It'll play out, because there's about a paragraph or two in the majority opinion about that, saying we're not intending to impose on the teaching of religion. It was interesting, it didn't talk about the exercise of your religion. So as one of the dissenting justices, Justice Roberts, said, this is going to be played out in a later day, so it's a little concerning. But as of right now, you know, for example, the Iowa Civil Rights Act, which is kind of our version, the state version of the Civil Rights Act, it's clear, it's in it's in there about the ability of religious organizations to discriminate on the basis of religion. So it'll say, this is in the employment context. It is right in the Iowa Civil Rights Act. Any bona fide religious institution or its educational facility, association, or society with respect to any qualification for employment based on religion, sexual orientation, or gender identity when such qualifications are related to a bona fide religious purpose. So again, saying that it's discriminatory, anti-discriminatory provisions don't apply in this context when there is that bona fide religious purpose. So again, getting back to that, the idea of basing your decision in religion and scripture. Same thing on the facility piece. Again, the current Iowa Civil Rights Act, talking about unfair practices in opening up your facilities, right now specifically says this section shall not apply to any bona fide religious institution with respect to any qualifications the institution may impose based on religion when such qualifications are related to a bona fide religious purpose. Just saying again that we are, at this point, free to discriminate, if you will, on the basis of religion only. So we want to frame the debate in the context and religious versus other issues. So thank you. I think that may... Oh, one more. Uh-oh. He's got you, actually.
Okay, we struck on kind of a passionate comment. I mean, I'm a registered nurse. The topic was safer where you worship. And, you know, I look at the mandatory reporters that are outlined here, and I think it would be a poor statement to say that they're not just as much working in that capacity, you know, law enforcement, health professionals, any professional you have in your congregation. You know, one of the other things that registered nurses are responsible in doing is a dependent adult abuse, you know, and that might possibly down the road tie into the same sex and all those other issues. But I can guarantee you that if there is an emergency in the church, everybody knows who the nurse is.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that comment. Absolutely. So, but I wanted to thank you for your time and for your attention. I know it's not, like I said, fun stuff. It's not why we're doing ministry, but it's kind of the reality of ministry in 2015. So as Sky said, we want to come alongside you to help you do that as much as we can. So both he and I would be glad to be able to reach out to you to answer any questions or communications even beyond today. But thank you so much for having us. We appreciate it. So.